You come from an investment banking background. You spent some time as a founder where you built out a company. And then you've also seen the growth stage, you know, seed stage, VC game in developed economies.
Yeah.
Talk to us about how all of that panned out and what was life before Lumakai.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. Well, statistically, I shouldn't even be here, right? Because I grew up playing games, but I never saw anyone who looked like me in a game world.
Mm-hmm.
I then went on to build a gaming company, but I never saw anybody like me actually building games company. Mm-hmm. And I never saw anyone like me on the funding side of the table. So, you know, it said, if you can't see it, you can't be it. So, you know, to be honest, I was the ultimate outsider to the gaming world. And mm-hmm. when you look at the stats, I really shouldn't be here. But I am.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj, and today I have me a very special guest. Thank you so much, Saloni, for joining me. Saloni is the general partner and the founding partner at Lumakai, which is an interactive media and gaming fund, the only one in India and doing incredibly well, setting some very ambitious standards for future fund managers and for gaming entrepreneurs. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Jivraj, for having me.
Pleasure's all mine, and I'm very excited to have a very offbeat conversation because I'm used to speaking to founders or fund managers who invest in the more mainstream categories, if I had to call it that.
True.
But of course, gaming is one that is not just niche, but ultra huge,
mm-hmm.
As I found out in my research when reading more about you and learning about you. Through the next couple of minutes, you know, Saloni, I'd love to focus on how you've gone about building the fund. What are the interesting observations you have that we perhaps don't really realize? But before we get there, you've had a very illustrious career before that, right? I mean, you come from an investment banking background. You spent some time as a founder where you built out a company. And then you've also seen the growth stage, you know, seed stage, VC game in developed economies.
Yeah.
Talk to us about how all of that panned out and what was life before Lumakai.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. Well, statistically, I shouldn't even be here, right? Because I grew up playing games, but I never saw anyone who looked like me in a game world.
Mm-hmm.
I then went on to build a gaming company, but I never saw anybody like me actually building games company. Mm-hmm. And I never saw anyone like me on the funding side of the table. So, you know, it said, if you can't see it, you can't be it. So, you know, to be honest, I was the ultimate outsider to the gaming world. And mm-hmm. when you look at the stats, I really shouldn't be here. But I am.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what I am, who I am at this point of time has been a culmination of about 15 odd years of being an investor, being an entrepreneur, and being a former M&A banker. So, you know, prior to Lumakai, I was with a fund called London Venture Partners, or LVP. And that was a fund which essentially pioneered investing in gaming and interactive media as an asset class. You know, the fund and the partners had a track record of backing over 40-odd companies, which eventually went on to deliver $20 billion in exits. And through that, I had a front row seat of what it means to really build world-class gaming companies, and got exposed to what best-in-class in Europe and North America looks like. But at the same time, it also allowed me to build a very large network of just global games industry folks as well. And I had, known the LVP team for a very long time because they were also investors in my own venture. So I built a gaming company and ran that for 4 years, which was building immersive social world games, mm-hmm. but with a focus on female audiences. And, you know, when I mean immersive social world, it was probably before the metaverse became cool. But that was an incredible learning experience because, you know, I came to being an entrepreneur actually from spending the first 6-7 years of my career in investment banking and private equity. So I had to unlearn a lot of things that I had learned as a banker.
Yeah.
And I realized that, you know, you as an entrepreneur, all these frameworks that you have as an advisor and as an M&A banker, you throw that out the window and you start really from scratch. And it was an incredible learning experience because I learned a lot about this industry,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, a lot of people think is very niche, but it's actually incredibly mainstream.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot about how to manage people, how to run a business, how to scale a company, how to, you know, operate in new markets. And that was an incredible learning experience. And of course, you know, before that, I came from Morgan Stanley, Barclays, did over $10 billion in M&A deals, spent about, also had a short stint in a Switzerland-based private equity fund, which managed about 6 billion euros of AUM, and actually started my career in India, not very far off from here, in a big four. It's been quite a journey. Mm-hmm. But I guess circling back to more current times, you know, at Lumikai happened in 2019, where the first seeds of setting up a sector focus fund for the India market germinated. And, you know, I'd seen the rise of markets like China, seen the rise of markets like Turkey, particularly in gaming and interactive. And at that point of time, it really felt like it was the right moment for a similar strategy for the India market. And, you know, I joined hands with my co-GP, Justin, in Jan 2020, and we had a fund up and running in August. But I will be very honest and tell you that it was probably the hardest year to launch a debut fund because it was in the middle of the pandemic. But that's Lumikai's origin story.
No, that's lovely. I think it goes to show that if you have a genuine passion towards something that you're willing to explore and be audacious like you were, you reach places that become aspirational for others, and hopefully we can understand on a deeper level why. Tell us, was there something special about gaming that made you explore this time and again? Did you ever wonder if this is a niche, as they say, or was that ever a concern when you were building? I mean, before Lumikai, what was the influence that led you to say that, okay, this is where I'm going to spend a considerable portion of my lifetime?
So I think, I was a passionate gamer. So I was an avid reader and an avid gamer as a kid, right? So spent hours playing Civilization and Age of Empires and The Sims. But, you know, at that point of time, I guess I did not perceive that this would be my career. But there was always one kernel of thought which had stayed in my mind, is that I didn't see anyone like me in a game world. And those words really stuck by me, because, you know, if you have to see a brown Indian female protagonist in a game world, the likelihood is I'll probably have to build it myself. But, you know, fast forward many years, you know, when I was setting up my company, I think the genesis of that idea was born out of the fact of this very startling fact that actually 60% of the world's casual gamers are women, but less than 20 to 30% of games and apps are actually built for them and towards them. And that's what the idea germinated from, is to how do you build this immersive social world, which is, you know, it's inclusive, it is diverse, and it is built for female audiences. And that was how my journey into entrepreneurship started. And over time, what I deeply appreciate about the gaming industry is that there is no other industry which spends so much time focused on user and player experience, right? The level of analytics that gaming companies do is just unprecedented. You know, the ability to map a user and user behavior from the time you start playing the gaming experience to the time, you know, the user leaves the gaming experience, and what the user does in between is just absolutely unparalleled in terms of the level of analytics, in terms of just game design as a whole. But, you know, go back to just essentially any successful consumer-facing app that you like. It's the likelihood is it's probably a game mechanic in disguise, right? Instagram, the scrolling, the likes, the feed, the chats, all of these originated from gaming and game worlds. You know, RuneScape or messaging came from the early days of 4chan, badges, leaderboards, you know, all of these which were meant to incite, let's say, dopamine or to trigger serotonin in your brain. All of these companies, even, you know, whether it's a Robinhood or a Duolingo or even a Cred with Spin the Wheel, are actually using game mechanics in disguise. All of it is a desire to capture attention and to retain you as a consumer. And hence, you know, gaming stands at the vanguard of innovation. You know, that's what I believe. If you want to see what's going to be popular in tech 5 years from now, see what's happening in gaming today. And that's probably a good precursor of what's going to come.
That's amazing. I think very fascinating to hear that definition of gaming and put things into perspective. Let's come to present day, right? I mean, starting a fund, let alone a sector-focused fund, which is unprecedented in nature, can only be a massive challenge. What can you tell us about, you know, that building blocks? What did you imagine it to be when you conceptualized the idea to what it became when you, let's say, seeded and did you maybe your first deal, right? Like closing those first LP conversations. Mm-hmm. Maybe tell us things that we cannot imagine, you know, looking at it from the outside. What are things that we need to know about starting a vertical sector-focused fund in India?
So I think there are a couple of considerations here, right? One is the fund strategy that you adopt, you know, whether it's sector focused, whether it's sector agnostic, right? Then the stage at which you focus, the quantum of capital that you need, the where you need to raise capital from, and then the kind of institution you want to build. So I think these are like four or five key, very key important parameters that you need to evaluate. So I think the first is, you know, sector focus versus a more sector agnostic fund. I think it lends well to where the market was, our analysis of the market and expertise of the founding team. Okay. Right, building a venture capital fund is very unlike from running a just angel syndicate or let's say an angel investment portfolio, right? Because there are many other things to think about, especially when you start raising external capital and you have fiduciary responsibility. Absolutely. The incremental work that needs to be done while raising a fund is just 5x that, right? And that's something that I think as a first-time fund manager, you tend to underestimate the amount of time you will spend on fund ops and fund admin and documentation and lawyers and various vendors is something that most people underestimate. But to, I think, go back to the first point is, you know, sector focus versus sector agnostic. When I started mapping the India market, you know, it was very clear that India had now been through, I'd say, one full cycle and more of the venture capital fund, right? You know, funds which had started over a decade back were now seeing exits. The market was yielding returns. Obviously, it coincided with the biggest bull run that we've probably lived through. But India as a venture cycle had started to prove itself just as an asset class, right? So once that is done, it is then becomes time to set up sector-focused vehicles. And we've started to see that, right? Absolutely. We saw that with, let's say, a Fireside. We're seeing that with Omnivore and a few other sector-focused funds. I think the most important thing when you're setting up a sector-focused fund is what is the depth and breadth of the market, both in terms of ability to absorb capital, but also entrepreneurial talent, right? And then the third factor becomes the ability of this sector to be able to deliver financial upside. And then that is a reflection of where we feel the market is going to go. You know, our belief was, and we had a few hypotheses on where the India market was going to go. The reason why we had such a strong belief was simply because we had mapped the market. And, you know, as I hinted a little bit before, we'd seen what China looked like. We'd seen what Turkey looked like. And we'd seen all these countries go through certain inflection points, and those very same inflection points were very visible to us in the India market, and it made sense for us to set up a seed stage strategy which would be very pertinent for this sector, but we also felt it was the right time and where we can deploy this capital but also achieve a financial upside. And then it reflect went back into the expertise that me and my founding GP had, and finally the question then became, what is going to be the ethos of this venture institution that we bring? Our aim was that we wanted to be a multi-fund franchise, right? So how do you build that institution, that those kind of operational best practices, the kind of deals that you do, the kind of team that you hire, then that those building blocks need to be laid from day one. It's not something you tack on, but it's something that you tackle from day one. And it's very important to then also really evaluate what is going to be your right to win, because cracking venture capital, setting up a new fund, entering it and disrupting this existing incumbent of, you know, some very, very marquee names, what is going to be your key differentiator becomes incredibly important. And in our case, it was our sector expertise. It was our hypothesis on the market, which did pan out. Fortunately, we did some early deals which yielded upside in the ability of the founders to raise capital, in our ability to help these companies raise capital and add value to them. And the fourth is, you know, just our LPs seeing what we saw in the market and just the broader ecosystem now realizing that gaming is such a large opportunity. So I think all of that was came into being, I think.
Got it. No, that's very fascinating. Thanks for sharing that, because I think it clarifies a lot of fundamental understanding about how you looked at things. It also shows and displays a lot of foresight and clarity of thought. And I've observed in, you know, previous conversations in public where you've been very evident in terms of, you know, the thesis that you had for the market. Are there anything on the, you know, on the qualitative side, if you had to talk to us about how you develop some sort of foresight or clarity of thought, what would you have to say?
So I, you know, a lot of our kind of work, what we do is, you know, we really go deep into the market, and eventually, you know, we picked a very contrarian approach, right? Yeah. So sometimes being contrarian means seeing things other people don't, mm-hmm. or seeing things differently from the way other people do, yeah. right? And that's where I believe financial upside lies, right? Because if you see everything that everybody else does, yeah. that is probably no way to make alpha, generate alpha as it is, or to generate outlier returns. Yeah. And the only way to do that in a market is to be able to really go deep into a sector and get nuggets of information, which made us really believe that, yes, this is a sector worth pursuing. You know, so very early on when we were launching the fund, I often heard things like, oh, India can't do a sector-focused strategy. In India, people don't play games, or Indians don't pay for games. You will not find enough entrepreneurial talent. There's never going to be any kind of return that you will see in this market. So I heard all of those narratives. Mm-hmm. And the data was telling us otherwise. Yeah. And every year since the time we have launched and we've incepted the fund, what we've taken upon ourselves to do is to launch a research report, which yeah. essentially maps the market, right? It right. gives very, very detailed overview of the size of the market, what is the size of gamers, you know, what is the potential of monetization. And all these so-called narratives over the last 2.5 years have played out extremely differently. Right. Mm-hmm. The market is, you know, at this point of time, a $2.5 billion market, and it's growing at 30%. Actually, gaming is one of the fastest growing markets in the country and also in the world. It's a reflection of world trends, right? Where yeah. gaming is becoming a $250-300 billion market. It's growing at double digit growth rates because there is this entire generation of young people who've grown up with their devices on their hands being their primary medium of interaction with that of the world. Mm. And combined and coupled that with, let's say, technological advancement, where all the world's immersion and interactivity is possible within the palms of your hand, yeah. you know, you marry those two together, and of course you're going to get, you know, gaming experiences. Mm. And that is a trend that has come to India as well. You know, we've got 500 million gamers, and India has the fastest new payer user growth of anywhere in the world, and we're seeing those trends. Mm. In the last 2.5 years now, this year, revenue growth across the top 25 grossing apps, games, actually outstripped download growth for the very first time. Out of the 25 top grossing apps in the country, 45% are games at this wow. point of time. And we know globally, 60% of all App Store revenue is driven by gaming. And it's very, yeah. very interesting to see how India's inching up to that global average. So mm-hmm. when you start to see these stats, when you start to see these numbers, the opportunity becomes yeah. Very, very obvious often. But mm-hmm. about 2.5 years back, it wasn't so. But yeah. now I believe there's a lot more investor interest. There's a lot more founders who are building in the space. I mean, we ourselves have seen over 1,300 odd deals in the ecosystem, yeah. right? And we've built a portfolio of about 12, 13 odd companies that we've backed just from the first fund. Yeah. And that's been a really incredible journey for us.
Absolutely, definitely shows. And I think the ecosystem needed something like this to be pioneered. And it's great that, you know, there are players like Lumikai who can build sector-focused funds, because that's how the ecosystem will grow. And I think the action is definitely evident. What I'd love to know is now perhaps the delta from starting the fund to what it is now, not just from a deployment lens, but from a more qualitative lens of, you know, how you thought the institutional approach will play out, how you thought you'll maybe gather talent for the fund, the mm-hmm. culture that you hope to set out. what founders are saying about you, what you are observing from founders in your portfolio and beyond, the kind of talent that's coming up in teams, right? What is the observation like from a ground perspective? And also as a, you know, first-time GP of a fund, what are these, you know, different sort of strategic challenges to building a fund as an institution from that day one, considering that, you know, you don't have the benefit of portfolio, you don't have the benefit of like a marquee name that has been around for like decades. How do you go ahead and build this venture capital brand that people talk about, but is not understood as well? Would love to know that from you.
Yeah, I think that's really such a thought-provoking question, right? It's something that I think as a fund manager, as a VC, as a GP of a VC fund, it keeps me up at night, right? Our first challenge was essentially more existential survival. You know, how do we see enough deals to be able to find the right companies to be then be able to generate financial upside, right? That was the challenge. Yeah. Well, actually, before that challenge was, hey, where do we source capital from? You know, we're first-time fund managers, so where do we source capital from? So the way, you know, our way of thinking about it was we went to our obvious network. Both my co-GP and I, we came from the gaming world, and we had a set of strategics and investors who we had known over our careers. And, you know, some of them were investors in the previous fund that I was with. And we just went and talked to them. And obviously, we were constrained by the fact that it was COVID. It was our debut fund. Our ability to fundraise was severely hampered as well. So, you know, we went to a cohort of our network, and that happened to be some of the world's largest institutions and strategics and some family offices, and we laid out our thesis and our hypothesis. And I'd say fund one was our product market fit, where we presented our view of the market and we said this is where we think it'll evolve, and we'd love to have you guys on this journey with us. And we were very fortunate that, you know, these investors decided to back us. So in fund one, 85% of our capital is actually institutional. We have only three individuals in the fund, and we have some select family offices, but we're very, very grateful to the support of these, you know, some of these world-class strategics and corporates and these multi-billion dollar conglomerates who decided to support us. And that was, I guess, the first, you know, crossing that first threshold was, you know, raising the capital. The second threshold is, well, how do we start to source deals, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, typically there are three channels of sourcing deals for funds, right? Either you get them inbound, or you get referred deals, or you scout deals, right? Now, there is, I'd say in venture capital, there is a very heavy dependence on inbound deals, right? Everybody says, hey, you know, find me a warm intro. As a new fund, we actively said, we don't care about a warm intro or a cold intro, because this is the problem where it perpetuates in venture capital, where, you know, you end up backing founders who look like each other, who are, you know, very similar. And especially we are a new fund, we're backing a new sector, we want to be as open as possible. So we actively encourage people to reach out to us. And we also actively set up a process where we reach out to founders way before they're even thinking of, let's say, setting up a company, right? We maintain something called a future founders list, where we scout out profiles of people in the industry who we think could be potential founders, and, you know, start engaging with them very early on. And eventually, when we think, you know, they're ready for taking the plunge into entrepreneurship, we're often the first port of call for them. And in this manner, I feel we have been able to diversify our deal flow sources. It has also enabled us to see a lot, which is very important, because you need to see a lot to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff and to develop some kind of pattern recognition as well, right? And I'd say all these three channels have actually yielded us deal flow. So all of them are actually very active for us. Now, once you do the deal, then the big challenge comes as, well, how do you service the portfolio, right? Yeah. And at the early stage, capital is only one of the problems that founders face, especially at the super seed stage that we come in. We're often the first institution in. So we created, you know, five clear levers of where we feel we can support the founders. You know, the first is obviously capital. That also includes their follow-on round. So we'll work with our founders on, let's say, fundraising story, if they required seeing a pitch deck, how do they craft the positioning of the company, introductions to, let's say, future investors. You know, we kind of assist founders in that. The second is a more strategic. This involves everything from product reviews, competitive landscape, scoping, brainstorming on strategic direction, introductions to, let's say, strategic partners. This is something we will assist founders with. The third is hiring, right? Talent can often be a catalyst to changing the fortunes of young founders and founding companies. So we maintain a proprietary recruitment database of talent that we spot and we scout in the ecosystem. And typically when our founders say, hey, we need this individual or we need this particular profile, we tend to go back to that database to see if we have people in our network who we could refer to our founders and eventually pass, and that helps them parse through those profiles. And then eventually, if need be, we'll do interviews also to assist the founders as well, to just give them another point of view. Right. Then we, you know, distribution is very important, you know, so whether it's maintaining good relationships with the various platforms, analytics tools, engines, etc., that's also something that we take upon ourselves. And the last is, you know, more emotional support, and this is obviously available for founders, but, and I've been a founder before, and I've realized that actually most founders need coaches because they are like athletes, right? And every athlete needs a coach. My belief is every founder needs a coach. Mm-hmm. And we have a panel of performance coaches who are available to work with our founders, and it can be anything from I'm starting up and I want to think of how do I codify values, vision, and mission. Or it can be I have set up the company, but I want to work on productivity and motivation. Or it can be anything from, hey, I want personal leadership coaching for my own. How do I grow into the leader that I think I can be? Mm-hmm. Right. So again, five parameters of, you know, how do we manage and assist our portfolio? And how do we help them from this, you know, this 0 to 1 or 0 to 10 journey? And that's on the portfolio management side. Then the third aspect becomes LPs, right? How do you service your LPs? Because you have two kinds of stakeholders. One, you've got investors who've entrusted their capital with you. And then the other side, you've got portfolio founders who you're working with to hopefully yield some value creation. So on the LP side, you know, the first commitment was that we are building an institution here. And when it's an institution, it needs to be an enduring venture capital institution. So that means, you know, whether it's documentation, whether it is processes, whether it's investment checklists, whether it's investor reporting, whether it's quarterly calls, etc., we have a cadence set up for all of it, right? We speak to our LPs every quarter. We have investor reporting. Our investor reporting is quite robust from the feedback that our LPs have given us. You know, the good, the bad, the ugly, it's a 10-year journey. You have to share it all, right? And so that's on the investor reporting side. And then the final part is, you know, ecosystem building. Yeah. How do you build the ecosystem? Now, that can be, in our case, has been a lot of education. Yeah. You know, how do we share our knowledge with the larger ecosystem, whether it's through thought leadership, whether it's through research, whether it's through blog posts. So everybody in the team is essentially geared towards that. Yeah. And the last is team, right? Eventually, we can't do this without having the right experts, both from a domain expertise side and from a sector expertise side to even functional experience. You want to build a team which is diverse. That is very important for us. You know, we have a 40% female team, which is very, very distinct from, let's say, most venture funds. Yes. We're very friendly in terms of having family-friendly policies, whether it's work from home, whether it's nanny care, whether it's work from home allowances, you know, sensitized job descriptions, you know, all of that is something that we've institutionalized. And also just ensuring that we as a team do regular coaching, right? You know, we have quarterly coaching sessions where we have a external coach who'll come in and we'll run workshops for the team as well. And how do we institutionalize reflection and introspection as a fund is very important to us, because that's how you build your muscle as an investment manager, right? Yes, you're going to make a lot of mistakes, but it's important how do you learn from it. So you debrief on decisions. And that's very important as a team. So I think it's, you know, all of this is something that we didn't happen from day one, but it's definitely something that we think about very, very regularly.
Brilliant. I think that's spectacular. That's almost in and of itself a masterclass on, you know, running a fund, because you've covered all of those dimensions incredibly well. Two thoughts come to mind, and maybe this is a divergence, but Why don't you tell us the importance of coaching more so, right? Because while we do have these analogies that the founders are players, VCs are coaches, all of that, in the tangible sense of it, I've not heard it being emphasized as much as it was by you. So if you can maybe talk to us about the role of coaching, maybe in your life, in the team, or just from a founder lens also, why it's important, why should it be emphasized and prioritized, would love that.
Sure. Look, I mean, you know, this is something that I experienced as a first-time entrepreneur when I was building my company, right? Entrepreneurs are like athletes, right? But like, you have to have the mental fortitude, the perseverance, the tenacity to be able to achieve your goal. Mm-hmm. And like every athlete, you have a performance coach who is egging them on and to some extent, you know, enabling the athlete to get out of their own way. You need that as an entrepreneur as mm-hmm. well, because you are caught up on a day-to-day basis with many things, especially as an early stage founder. You know, you are tackling with things like, am I good enough? Is there you have that imposter syndrome. Then you have to lead a team. How do you lead that team? If you're a creative person previously, how do you then suddenly become CEO? Or if you're a technical person, how do you suddenly rise to the occasion of your CEO? How do you manage your board? How do you raise funds? You know, you ask yourself questions like, am I too aggressive with my team? Or am I too soft with my team? How do I think about high performance? How do I build accountability? And all of these are questions that founders deal with on a daily basis, right? How do I achieve alignment on strategy with my team? How do I retain people? You know, once hiring is such a long, rigorous process, that then how do you think about culture? Is culture, you know, free food at work, or is culture what people feel on a Sunday night thinking about your Monday morning? And all of these, I guess, are things that coaching can help you resolve, because eventually the idea of coaching is to be able to surpass your own limits that you have set yourself and start to see things from, I'd say, what is called a balcony view. You know, you get a balcony view to your own life, and hence you're able to just take a step back and just see what's going on and be able to take better decisions. Eventually, as a founder, you have to do context switching multiple times a day, and you have to take very quick decisions. So often the quality of your decision will show up very immediately in terms of an output, right? So how do you make sure that input is good? And this is essentially what coaching can enable for you. And sadly, not too many investors talk about this aspect, right? A lot of it is, you know, what is your KPIs? What is your growth? What is your product looking like? What is your competitive landscape looking like? And all of that is important. I think, don't get me wrong, I think if you don't have any of those ducks in place, you know, probably your company is not going to go anywhere. But beyond that, as a founder, it's often how you show up in an organization is going to heavily influence how the company is going to operate and how your leadership team operates as well. And that is a very critical part. So working on yourself as a founder is incredibly critical. It's not something you do at Series B. It's not something you do at Series C. It's something you do from day one.
Absolutely.
You know, how do you think about your values? How does that echo with the values of the company that you're trying to build? All of that becomes critical. And all of the best founders in the world, whether it's Sam Altman, whether it's Reed Hastings, all of them are coached. In fact, you know, I wrote this blog post. It's called The Entrepreneur Athlete. But I don't know if you saw this show called Billions. You know, Billions had a very, very famous character, psychologist character called Wendy Rhodes, who was specifically there to motivate the traders and the investment managers. And actually, Wendy Rhodes is based on a real character. It's based on she's a coach called Denise Schull, and it's based on her. And she actually used to be a coach for a very large hedge fund manager. It's simply to help to help get you out of your head and to get you out of your own way.
Brilliant. I mean, that's a lot of good food for thought. And I think for those who haven't considered coaching in the past or have not realized the gravitas of it, I think this is going to go a long way in just instilling that thought process and maybe even in adoption. Thanks for mentioning that. One thing that I'd love to know is, in the ambit of things that you mentioned, right, it seems like much of this has to be prioritized vis-a-vis much of this has to be delegated.
Mm.
As a fund manager, what are things that are top of mind for you? And almost like, you know, instilling this founder character, because I ask a lot of founders this, how do you manage this short-term, long-term problem, mm. right? Like, I'm sure there is these specific things that only you have context to, which is in your head, like with your co-GP, that maybe is not transferable to words, but there are also things that have to be immediately done,
absolutely.
Right? Which are important for the functioning of the fund.
Yeah.
Talk to us about some of these prioritization tactics, short-term, long-term aspects of being a fund manager.
Yeah, and you know, I think that's often the trade-off between what's urgent versus what's important, right?
Yeah.
And that's almost on a daily basis. It's something that we tackle as a VC fund, especially as a young VC fund, especially as a small team. The first, I'd say, is we're very transparent in the fund, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we discuss our fund as a team, you know, again, we as co-GPs, we've made it very clear that, you know, everybody in the team contributes to all aspects of the fund, because, you know, given that we are a small fund, we don't have silos here.
Mm-hmm.
So whether it's the investment team or whether it's the fund ops finance team, you know, it's in a lot of funds it gets segregated. That's
yeah.
not the case with us, right?
Well,
so everybody is well aware of what, let's say, our deal flow priorities are, what our fundraising priorities are, if we are fundraising, what our portfolio priorities are. And that to some extent, you know, helps people have a very long-term view of, okay, where the fund going.
Mm-hmm.
Every year we do goal setting, right, at the beginning of the year, and we will demarcate or essentially highlight the goals that we want to achieve in a particular year, whether it is deal flow, whether it's portfolio, LPs, and ecosystem and hiring, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are essentially the five parameters with the way we look at the fund. And this goal setting exercise really helps at least transmit to the team what is important in the long term and how do they kind of keep that in mind when they're
yeah.
delivering on their day-to-day. And then on a weekly basis, we often determine priorities for the week, right? So that further helps distill and break down the larger priorities into smaller actionable items that need to be prioritized and done on a weekly basis. And then eventually, you know, you have daily priorities. But, you know, transparency, goal orientation, a bias for action are all very critical muscles for a organization to have and develop. And that's something that we do quite mindfully.
Got it. No, I think that shows a lot of process orientation and clarity of thought. So definitely looks like things which have been chalked out internally and spoken about. One last bit on the fund would be, you know, there are these things that each fund stand for, right? Almost like the fabric of the fund. Some people define it as founders first. Some people define it as, you know, being very special and having very special founders around you. What is it for Lumikai, right? In different words, like if you had to maybe like give us the culture background or like the fabric of the fund, what would you tell us?
So, you know, I think it's in our word. It's in the name of the fund.
Okay.
It's a portmanteau for Lumi is a Latin word for light. And
mm-hmm.
Japanese, Kai is the Japanese word for tribe. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
when you bring it together, it's essentially a
yeah.
tribe of light or light bearers in a
mm-hmm.
way. So the way we look at it in the ethos of the fund is that how do we be that lighthouse fund in the interactive media space? So that often translates into, you know, how do we have clarity about what we want to do? How do we stay ahead of the curve? How do we have passion? Everybody in the team is a gamer. And how do we have integrity in the kind of work that we perform? So, you know, that is very deeply embroiled in the DNA of the fund, is how do we always stay ahead of the curve and be the lighthouse that is so very part of the, even the name of the fund.
Wow, that's a very fascinating, interesting story, and lovely to know that, you know, it just reflects on the name. Taking a different direction to the conversation, Saloni, I'd love to understand that, you know, much of what an investor does is also like just hang around with these outlier
yeah.
special founders, right, who have this massive capability of generating value year on year and fulfill their visions. What are some founder traits that have really impressed you? And I mean, what do you look out for almost to say that, okay, if you could identify these traits in an early stage founder, that would make your day?
Yeah. You know, so over the years, I have had multiple, I guess, iterations of this framework, but eventually I've basically, you know, all the years of experiences, speaking to hundreds of founders, working and advising and investing and operating over the last 15, 16 odd years, you know, eventually it's come down to what I call the 5C framework. And this is something that I've, you know, feel works for us as a fund. And, you know, it's essentially evaluating and analyzing founders on these 5 C's, the first of which is competence, right? Mm-hmm. Is the founder competent to build in the space that they're building? You know, either it can be through their previous work experience, or it can be through just a unique insight or just a unique kind of understanding of the market, but are they competent enough to build in the space that they are building? And that becomes a very important criteria for evaluation. The second is clarity. You know, clarity of vision, clarity of communication, clarity of mission, clarity in just being able to sell their vision to employees, to investors, how they want to develop their product roadmap. But clarity is an incredible criteria, incredibly important criteria that is, and especially one that I see and I rate very highly in outlier founders, right? They are extremely clear in what they want to do and build. The third is curiosity. Are they learning machines? Are they constantly adapting? You know, it could be curiosity about your competitor. It could be curiosity about the landscape. It could be curiosity about developing your own skill set. But this curiosity is deeply important to us as well. The fourth is commitment. Mm-hmm. You know, how committed are you going to be on this journey? Because entrepreneurship can't be part-time. You know, it's something that is going to consume your life. It is probably something that's going to consume your mind space for years to come. And that level of commitment, that level of tenacity, that perseverance is, again, something that, you know, I see, again, very highly in outlier founders, but again, something that I look out for. And the last is character. You know, without character, all of these others are pointless, right? And character is work ethic, it is integrity, it is, you know, knowing the difference between right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And it is the way you interact with people around you, the way you treat people around you. All of that gets reflected into character, you know? So essentially it's the 5C framework. So competence, clarity, curiosity, commitment, and character. And these are the 5 frameworks with which I've, you know, evaluate founders with.
Got it. I could sound a bit repetitive, but I'm loving each structured answer in a very, very meaningful way, because I think it just goes to show your clarity of thought and the time you've perhaps spent on building these frameworks out. And I think this is going to be mega useful for anyone listening. I'd also love to maybe take a step back and understand about the interactive media side of things. Sure. Because I've been subject to, you know, perhaps thinking that Lumika is a gaming fund. But when you look closely, gaming is not just what we look and feel and touch in terms of absolute games.
That's right.
There is a very definitive mention of interactive media when you speak, when team members speak. And of course, that broadens the ambit of what you do.
Absolutely.
Maybe talk to us about what this means, right, in the context of things. And talk to us about what you were earlier referring to, right? There are so many consumer internet companies which fundamentally leverage gaming aspects, if I can put it that way. And what does that amount to, right? So if you can give us a precursor, that'll be helpful.
Yeah, so I think, you know, interactive media is so broad as it is deep. You know, when people think of interactive media, they typically just think of gaming. And when you say gaming, people will see an image of a 13-year-old boy sitting in his basement playing Counter-Strike or Quake. Right, and that's often the image that one gets of gaming. And I feel like that there is so much more to gaming than what people originally think of. And the way we look at the sector is essentially, you know, there are content bets that we do, which are essentially gaming companies building content. It could be for the India market, for the global market. We look at platform plays. So this could be social gaming platform or game streaming platforms. We've done a bet called Loco. We've done a bet called LOLO. We also look at tools, tech, infrastructure plays. So all the enabling infrastructure which makes these B2C, front-facing, forward-facing consumer experiences happen rests upon a very, very deep stack of tools and infrastructure, analytics. So we look at that space as well. Then we look at what we call systems of play, right? Interactive mechanics are really eating the world. You know, no matter what experience you pick up, whatever consumer-facing device, consumer-facing app that you use, all of them have game mechanics. But our thesis is a little bit deeper, is that how do we use systems of play to disrupt, let's say, traditional industries? Could it be EdTech? How do we break down all the fixed costs of, let's say, EdTech companies by building gaming-native pedagogy? I'm sure, you know, there are enough kids who are saying Roblox and Minecraft and Prodigy teaching math is far more educational than anything that in their curriculum. Or how do you adapt curriculum to, let's say, gaming-native formats to be able to teach kids much faster in a format that they're much more now used to? It could be fintech. It could be health tech. You know, how do you bring interactive mechanics or game mechanics eventually to be able to disrupt traditional industries is also a key part of our thesis. And then, of course, there are more of the frontier bets. You know, people cast frontier as mixed reality, as metaverse, Web3, whatever that is at that point of time. I think that is more frontier bets. And it's very important to understand that interactive media as a sector eventually is ultimately the confluence of new media, culture, and technology. That's what interactive media is. And interactive media is a dynamic industry. It's changing every 3 to 4 years, especially with the technology evolution that's arriving, right? Mm-hmm. Now, for example, with generative AI at the moment, there is a massive space for how do you simplify and make it easier to create 3D content? Like, how do you really transform content creation? And who's going to be the biggest beneficiary of it is it's probably going to be gaming companies, right? Because gaming companies are all built about how do we immerse you in those experiences? But that kind of content is really expensive to make. It's very, very time consuming. And it just has a very long production cycle. So now with Gen AI, a lot of questions are being asked is that how do you shorten that? How do you make it cheaper? How do you make it faster? And again, that will enable UGC experiences at a scale that we've never seen before. And probably the first industry to adopt it is going to be gaming, like any other industry. So this is essentially the wrapper of what interactive media means for us.
Awesome. I think that clarifies a lot. Considering that some of this spectrum can tend to get pretty wide in nature and ever-growing, nobody could have perceived what generative AI has become and only what it will become. How do you stay on top of, you know, some of these trends? And I'm guessing this is a question for each investor, is to, you know, how do you predict the future while living it? What are tools or, you know, just personal mechanisms that you've come to admire that have helped you stay on top of some of these sectors that helps the team stay ahead of the curve?
Well, being sector focused helps, right? We don't get distracted. And that's why we are so data oriented. This is why we are so research oriented, right? Every quarter internally, we do a piece of thesis and we do a piece of research, which is just for internal purposes, which could be a new trend that we've seen. It could be a new area that we are mapping, but we go pretty deep into that area, right? We'll speak to sector experts. We'll do a lot of ground research. We'll see what's happening in, let's say, certain markets of the world, and how do we make that possible? Let's say, how do we see that become possible, let's say, for the India market, right? So being sector focused, of course, is helpful. The second is, you, as a venture investor, curiosity is your biggest strength, right? So you have to keep ahead of the curve, and that can mean being doing a lot of reading or meeting a lot of sector experts as well. And you know, we're very thankful that we have a very large network of people in the global gaming market, global interactive media space, who are often at the cutting edge of what's taking place. Now, whether it's, you know, the technical lead at DeepMind, or whether it's folks at Epic Game, or whether it's the guys at Unity or Supercell, right? It's incredibly helpful to stay on top and talk to people, to be able to just be educated. And that is very informative for us. But I think thirdly is not letting, you know, being swept away by momentum is very critical, right? And a lot of the Web3 metaverse things that we saw in the last year, and you know, we put up a lot of posts around this, which were largely, I'd say, more cautionary around Web3 and the metaverse and how you know, how gaming companies were adapting towards it. And, you know, we'd seen similar hype cycles, let's say, what happened a couple of years back in VR, what happened a couple of years back in, let's say, esports. And, you know, we kind of could see the early signs of it even in the Web3 space. And that informed our decision. There was a little bit of a more pattern recognition here that we could do and say, hey, it looks a little bit like that. It's mm-hmm. probably not sustainable. And this is probably a hype cycle that we're in. And, you know, just being, just not getting carried away is deeply important with hype cycles is also another way, I'd say, of just staying mm-hmm. grounded and being very close to the market that you're investing in.
Got it. No, I think those are very fundamentally strong pointers. This has been very interesting, and maybe as we, you know, conclude, I have a series of similar questions that I ask most founders or investors on the show. One of the first ones there, Saloni, is maybe, so each investor has their individual distinctive factor, right? Almost like, how does a particular founder know me? Mm. If I had to ask you that, you know, what will a portfolio founder of Lumakai, or how will they define you? What would you have to tell us? What is the kind of investor that perfectly defines you?
Oh my God, that's a really good question. I actually, I don't know how to answer that. That's probably something that I'd say portfolio founders should be
interviewing them to ask.
You should be interviewing them. I don't know. You know, hopefully helpful.
Okay.
Is something that
let me rephrase. Yeah. What is that one thing that you as an investor are uniquely good at, better than maybe 90% of the investors out there?
I think as investors, we're deeply deeply insight driven. Mm-hmm. So I think what we like to share with founders is, you know, insights at least that we have gathered, right? Mm-hmm. And that also goes back a little bit to our experience, to our expertise as sector focused funds. To that extent, I'd say we'd like to be more insight driven. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not as much about gut, or, you know, we feel the product doesn't look good, or, you know, we don't like the way this appears. It's not mm-hmm. it's not gut oriented. It's not impulse oriented. I'd say we'd probably be more insight oriented as investors. And I hope that's what founders see in us.
Absolutely. No, that helps. I think very, very interesting. The second aspect of some of this is, you know, I really appreciate sometimes that founders and, you know, folks like you have a very individualistic personal process to just grow 10x every year, right? If I had to ask you what your mantra for just, like, you know, maybe upskilling, maybe, you know, reading, maybe just self-reflection, any of the things that you do to ensure you are just growing at phenomenal exponential rates would be very helpful to know.
Yeah, I think, you know, the one mantra that I try and prescribe by is, you know, if somebody had to, you know, probably leave an epitaph on the day I died, what they would say, I would probably, you know, I'd like for it to be, I don't know whether it is, but I'd like for it to be, you know, she does what she says and she says what she does. And if that's something that people remember me by, I think that's the goal that I aspire for, you know, as far as possible.
That's lovely. I think that has a lot of meaning and that has a lot of character. Thanks for mentioning that. For the second last question, I'd love to understand, as a leader of a venture fund, right? And I mean, as a leader who also sees founders lead just phenomenal companies at scale, products, people, what are leadership learnings that are very dear to you? And what do you think defines you from a leadership POV, and maybe learnings from that aspect that you can share?
Yeah, I think as a venture investor, you know, it is the first, I think, leadership aspect is just staying reflective and introspective, you know, mm-hmm. and that is something, again, I talked about, is that how do you even institutionalize it? How do you build that into the organizational muscle? That's something that I think about very, very deeply, because self-reflection, just self-introspection is so critical to being an investor, a good investor, right? You have to be able to at least demarcate luck from actual skill, You have to be able to evaluate whether it was a good decision which led to a good outcome, or was it a bad decision which led to a good outcome, or vice versa. Yeah. A bad decision led to a bad outcome, that's pretty obvious. But a bad decision leading to a good outcome, you've got to analyze that. You know, and sometimes it's very difficult to do that, especially when you've got a few successes. But as a investment manager, as a VC, that's something that is a process that I like to do internally. And that's a leadership lesson, is how to be deeply self-reflective, how to introspect. The second is, as an investor, again, not to get carried away with FOMO, right? Warren Buffett says, you know, be greedy when others are fearful, be fearful when others are greedy. And that's incredibly hard to do, because you do get caught up in the irrational exuberance of the market. You do get caught up in the irrational pessimism of the market as well. But bear cycles and bull cycles are part of the journey of being a venture fund manager, right? You are going to see these cycles. I have seen these cycles 3 times in different avatars of my own career. And, you know, we're going through this as first time GPs as well, right, of the fund. Soon to be, hopefully, second time GPs with an upcoming fund. But of course, this is deeply important for us as well. The third leadership, I'd say not leadership, but more insight that I've had over my investing journey as a fund, is who you invest with is almost as important as who you invest in, right? Because typically, these relationships are very long-standing. You know, these relationships on your board, relationship with co-investors are very, very long-standing. These are, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10-year relationships. And through those journeys, founders go through many, many peaks and troughs.
Yeah.
And often the founder's journey is not only going to be influenced by the inputs you provide, but also by the inputs of who the other investors are and how they navigate those decisions, how they basically support founders through turmoil, etc., how they assist founders in good times as well. And I think those are all incredibly important also to think of as a fund manager. Sometimes you will have a choice in determining who your co-investors are, and sometimes you may not.
Yeah.
But as far as possible, you know, work with people who are like-minded, who you have good experiences, when over time, and this is a reason why you'll see a lot of funds co-invest with each other, right? They build their trust and relationships. They know where people can add value or not. Yeah. And I think that's another insight that I've had as an investor. And then, of course, you know, you want to cultivate a place of trust with your founder where founders are free to come to you the first time shit hits the fan. Right. And I think that can be incredibly hard for a founder to even reach out and say, hey, I'm in trouble, I need help. I've been a founder. I understand how challenging that can be, especially where you don't want to show any kind of weakness or vulnerability to your investors. But it's something that I hope we as a fund, we're able to do. We're early in the journey, but as we go the years, I think that's hopefully something we should be able to do.
Got it. Again, I think that's very insightful and a lot of deep lessons there. I was going to end with a question, but you touched a interesting chord. Maybe you can spend a couple of quick minutes there. You spoke about luck, right? And I think that's very interesting, right? Like, not knowing how you win is a very interesting question. Was it luck? Can you attribute it to your process? Can you attribute it to things that you have identified uniquely? Talk to us about how all the more is it important in venture as a sport, right? Like what that means, how you look at luck and the importance of identifying how you win more than whether or not you do.
Sure. I mean, luck is deeply important to winning in venture, right? You can have all the plans, you can map all the inflection markers that you want to, but there can be a black swan event which can basically toss your thesis right out of the window. For example, crypto. Right, in India, right? The Indian government has taken a stand on crypto, which has wiped out a number of large crypto exchanges in the India market, right, at the moment. Now, was their thesis correct or not correct? Was their thesis on time, on point? Was the timing right? You know, is up for anybody's opinion, and leave that. But at the end of the day, the culmination of it not turning out to the outcome that people expected was a black swan event where the government essentially came out with certain measures which made the functioning of crypto companies to become unviable or unfeasible, right? Now, I think about it all the time. Like, for example, you know, we had certain hypotheses when we launched the fund, but what if regulatory changes moved against us, right? And we can see that in China, for example, right? There are a lot of regulatory changes happening on the gaming front, on the edtech front, where China's taking a very different approach, which is to some extent, curtailing the growth of companies in those sectors in that market. Now, of course, that can happen, right? Yeah. So luck is a very large component of being a venture investor. Sometimes you can have all your ducks in a row, but in the market doesn't pan out. Or sometimes you just don't expect the company that you backed 4 years back to suddenly have, you know, hit upon something, and, you know, fortunes change, and, you know, eventually they're off to the races, right? So I'd say it is venture investing, particularly, or for any kind of investing, I'd say luck has a very key role to play.
Absolutely. Well, that's lovely to mention. And I think coming to the last bit, I think it's important to echo that, you know, you are a woman doing incredibly well in an ecosystem where in investing, we have not had traditionally a lot of female participation, let alone participation. You're leading a firm from scratch and, you know, beating a lot of boundaries that way. Having said that, you know, if you had to highlight some core learnings for people who are, you know, aspiring to be on that chair sometime and do the things that you are, what would you like to mention in terms of just being a solo, a female GP in venture in India? What has that journey been like? What would you like to say on that?
You know, there are, as a woman in any field, you know, venture capital aside, as a woman in any field, you know, there are so many narratives around what you should be, what you should do, who you should be, that, you know, I said somewhere that it is often a small miracle that we be at all. Like, you know, it is a small miracle. You know, I heard this quote once, you know, Hillary Clinton said this, that it's tremendously hard to be a working woman. You know, you need to think like a man, you need to act like a lady, you need to look like a young girl, but you need to work like a horse. And this is the reality for a lot of women aspiring for leadership roles in any industry in the world at the moment. And yes, things are changing, but they're not changing fast enough, right? And this is where, you know, the endeavor for us is to be able to, for me, at least, is to be able to, you know, showcase and the possibility of what a career path, let's say, in venture looks like, right? My desire to be a VC manager or to be a GP was largely driven by the fact that I never saw anyone like me investing. I never saw anyone like me at the helm of a firm which was founded. And again, you know, I can count the number of founding female general partners of VC funds in India on one hand, literally, right? And you know, that's something that we need to change. You know, there's again this quote, right? If you see it, you can be it. And we've tried to launch a initiative in Lumikai called Lumikai Pathbreakers, which is essentially about showcasing women in leadership in gaming and interactive media, is essentially to showcase role models, right? To encourage more women to come in this space. It constitutes investors, game designers, narrative designers, developers, founders. And that's the essential endeavor, is that, you know, you see these women who've paved this pathway before you, so you think maybe that your journey can be a little bit easier. And I guess, you know, that's my mantra, is, you know, just, you have to just put yourself out there, tell your story, and hopefully it incites, you know, something in someone out there who says, well, hey, I can do this too.
Absolutely. That is brilliant to hear. And I'm so glad we could, you know, have that echoed, because we need more champions like you. And it's an absolute pleasure that you're doing what you are, and you are where you are, continuously moving towards your mission. Thank you so much, Saloni, for being on the show. This has been an absolute pleasure and absolute honor, if I might say, because we've covered so much ground. I mean, before the episode, my North Star was to, can we make this conversation where we uncover how to build a fund. But I think by the end of it, we've covered not just how to build a fund, but what the nuances of interactive media look like, what the nuances of investing look like, and much more. Thank you so much. Hope you had a great time.
I had a fantastic time. Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Great. Lovely to have you.